Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And if you've been a listener, you know that the show is dedicated to giving you in-depth conversations with people that are really providing us with knowledge, with insight, with a greater ability to have resources at hand. And that's really what it's all about. It's getting more empowered by accessing more knowledge, more resources, and being able to put them into action in our lives. So today we're going to have a fantastic conversation that will give you the tools to help you make a real difference in your life. Before we go there, I just want to welcome new listeners, and I certainly want to invite you to go to my website, which is whatwomenmustknow.com, because not only do I send all my radio shows out to you if you can't get to listen to them in the moment that they're playing, and also I have some special reports that are free, and I send them out to you when you opt into my newsletter. And also, the same is true for my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, which I post on a pretty regular basis. And again, it's filled with great information, empowering information, truthful information. So it just keeps you right there on the leading edge, knowing what's truly going on. So be sure to like me over there. Go over to whatwomenmustknow.com and get my free special reports. And all of these shows get posted on both of those places, so hope you'll join me there. Okay, so let's talk about how to calm an angry person in 90 seconds or less with my guest today, Douglas Knoll. So let me just tell you a little bit about Douglas. He holds both a JD and MA, which means he's a lawyer, and he left a successful career as a lawyer to become a peacemaker. He is an award-winning author, teacher, trainer, highly experienced mediator, and co-founder of the Prison of Peace Project. This has been the most profound peace training Douglas has conducted thus far in his career. Inmates who have gone through his program have learned and applied deep, empathetic, listening skills, leadership skills, and problem-solving skills to reduce violence in their prison communities. His latest book is De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. And the work that Douglas Knoll is doing is impacting people from all walks of life, in every area of our life. So this is a skill that we have very rarely, if ever, been taught. And it is such a critical skill. It's time that we learn it right now. So it is such a pleasure to welcome Douglas Knoll to the show today. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you, and we had a little conversation before the show began about how powerful it is to learn how to communicate in a way that lets people be heard and to understand the skills involved in de-escalating situations. So I want to start from the very beginning with you, Doug. It's like, what got you moving from your successful practice as a lawyer into this peacemaker world?
Well, it was a journey, and the journey took about 15 years. What happened was that I graduated from law school in 1977, and I clerked for an appellate judge for a year, and then went into private practice in September of 1978. And in November of 1978, I tried my first jury trial, and I became a trial lawyer. And for the next 22 years, that's what I did. Along the way, in the mid-80s, I took up the martial arts and was awarded my second degree black belt in a northern Chinese kung fu style, very violent form of martial art, when I was about 40 years old. And my teacher called me in and said, "You're done here. You're arrogant. You're full of yourself. You're a jerk. You're gonna hurt." And he just said it with a smile on his face to take the bite out. But he said, "You're going to hurt somebody. So I'm not teaching you anymore until you master Tai Chi." And at the time, I didn't know that that was a death sentence, but because you never master Tai Chi. But I said, I was a dutiful student, and I said, "All right, I'll go learn Tai Chi." So I found a teacher and started studying Tai Chi. Tai Chi has two very interesting paradoxes. The first is, the softer you are, the stronger you are. The second is, the more vulnerable you are, the more powerful you are. Soft to be strong, vulnerable to be powerful. And in fact, in Tai Chi, which is the oldest of all martial arts, that's exactly correct. If you try, it's completely counterintuitive to all other martial arts, where speed and strength determine how hard you hit. In Tai Chi, it's about being soft, the willow tree blowing in the wind, and that's how you use your opponent's energy. So I studied this and studied it and studied it and studied it, and for a long time didn't understand it, but it slowly seeped into me until one day, some years later, I was in a courtroom. And I was cross-examining somebody, and the thought came to me, what the heck am I doing in here? So after that trial, I had a vacation planned, and with a bunch of friends, we went up and ran the main salmon up in central Idaho. It's about a 115-mile whitewater trip. And I spent the week in my raft by myself thinking about how many people I'd served as a trial lawyer. And I concluded at the end of the trip that I hadn't served very many and that really wasn't my calling. I didn't want to go another 30 or 40 years and only serve maybe 20 people. I mean, people who really came out of the system better than going in. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew that maybe this wasn't going to work for me, being a trial lawyer. So I came back home, and I live in the mountains south of Yosemite, and I was driving down into town to my office, and I heard what turned out to be the one and only public service announcement on our public radio station for a new master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies. And that kind of got my attention. So I ended up going down to the university, Fresno Pacific University, which is the West Coast Mennonite University, and the Mennonites are one of the three traditional peace churches of the Protestant tradition. And so they were offering a master's degree in this stuff, and I got really interested in that. So I enrolled, and I became a full-time master's degree student carrying 12 units a semester and a full-time trial lawyer and a three-quarters-time law professor the next 3 years.
And Tai Chi student.
And at that time, then I was teaching Tai Chi. I was a Tai Chi master by then.
Oh,
so
wow.
I had students who were teaching. So, yeah, I was doing that and all the other craziness I've done in my life. So anyways, to make a fairly long story short, after discussions with my partners, half of whom thought a peacemaking practice would be really cool and half of whom were horrified at the idea that somebody as talented as I am and who had worked so hard to build a reputation as an aggressive take-no-prisoners trial lawyer would want to become a peacemaker, I left the firm. And I left right after my 50th birthday with no plan, and opened up my peacemaking and mediation practice and never looked back. And in the last 17 years, I have just done some really amazing things, and I've helped thousands of people resolve deep and intractable conflicts. And I'm a student of neuroscience. I learned that in my master's studies, that all conflict starts in the brain. So I've been tutored by John Allman at Caltech and some other folks, and so I'm really interested. I've always been interested in how the brain processes information and then taking it way beyond where the neuroscientists want to go and saying, all right, how does this knowledge apply in practical experience? I'm sitting here and I'm dealing with people who are raging at each other. What is it that I know about how their brains are processing information that I can use to help them calm down and start solving their problems? And so that's been my quest. We can talk about how I developed the techniques we're talking about, but that's basically how I went from being a trial lawyer to a peacemaker.
So it really sounds like you went through a profound transformation through martial arts and going from your very a comfortable, aggressive approach, which you used in your work, you used in your kung fu, to shifting something deep within you through Tai Chi and just the process of maturation of your soul, I would say, to get to another place.
Yeah, I mean, it was a spiritual journey. I left out that when I, as I studied Tai Chi, I began to learn how to manipulate Chi, and so I could blow out candles with my hand, with my energy and stuff like that, stuff that you'd see in the movies. Well, yeah, I can do that. And then that led me to becoming a healer, energetic healer, and that kind of blew me away. Because as a lawyer, I'm a naturally born skeptic, but I saw and experienced things that science cannot explain. but are real. And I learned that I had a facility for healing. And so, and then I went into deep meditation practice. I did a lot of contemplative practice in those years. So, yeah, it was a combination of all of that that sort of led me to the place where I am today.
So you're teaching what you best know yourself, moving from that rational left brain kind of, you know, aggressive male energy to that softer, intuitive, spiritual dimension of your being.
Well, I let that. I have a balance that I let guide me in my work. But let me tell you, when you walk into a serious conflict, there's no room for being soft. It's hard-nosed, practical stuff that's got to work, and it's got to work the first time, and there's no room for failure, because you know, the intensity of the emotions are so high that you really have to be balanced inside and be
yes.
confident of your ability to handle any situation that comes up. And I've seen just about everything. Weapons pulled. I mean, I've seen all kinds of stuff happen. You know, it's craziness.
But that's wonderful, because you've got that resource. You know how to use that energy, and you're comfortable with it when necessary.
Right.
But that's not the modus operandi in your life.
Right. I mean, you know, my life is it's all about service to humanity. And when I'm doing mediation work, it's all about helping people make choices. And usually it's taking the least worst choice and choosing it, because typically when people are in conflict, they don't have very many good choices open to them. So how do we find out what the least of the worst choices is, and can we accept the consequences of that choice 5 years, yeah. 10 years down the road?
So can we start by helping us to understand the neuroscience of the brain and how we process these emotions, particularly why
sure.
people have either a difficulty really communicating, expressing emotion, or are more comfortable by reacting with anger
yes.
and frustration rather than conversing?
Yes. So emotions, we're not taught much about emotions as children or even as adults, and it turns out that emotions are very complex. Emotions have two components to them. There's a cognitive component, and there is a physiological component, or what we would call an affective component. The affective, let's make it three comps: affective, physiological, and cognitive. So emotions arise in certain centers of the brain that are highly complex and still not well understood. Neuroscience is starting to get a better understanding, but it's still very complex, of an interplay between the wiring, how everything's wired up, and the chemicals that cause the wiring to work. Dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, you know, there are 150 different neurochemicals that affect how our brain operates. And so what happens is we are born with affect, which is the physiological response of the brain to something that happens in the environment. So let's take fear, for example. Most people are familiar with the amygdala. We have two of them. Amygdala means little almond in Latin, and we have two of these little almond-shaped processes in the center of our brains that act as an early warning system. And when I see a rattlesnake, I immediately jump back. My heart starts to pound. I, you know, start to perspire, and my body's activated to react. And only 750 milliseconds later, 3/4 of a second, does everything catch up to my prefrontal cortex, and I realize that's not a rattlesnake on the road; it's a broken oak branch. But if I didn't have that fear reaction, and it was a rattlesnake, I'd be cleaned out of the gene pool. So we, over evolution, over thousands, millions of years, we are the recipients of paranoid genes. You know, our predecessors who cuddled up to the saber-toothed tiger puppies or kittens were cleaned out pretty early, and we were the paranoid ones. And so we have these nine affects. Well, I think they're nine affects. I mean, I follow the word. I mean, I prefer Sylvan Tompkins' nine affect model. There are some neuroscientists who say there are only four affects. Some say there are five. Some say there are six. But Sylvan Tompkins, who was a brilliant psychologist in the 1960s, studied infants and determined through his studies that we really have nine affects, two of which are positive, two of which are neutral, and five of which are negative. These are the things that happen in the brain when there's some sort of environmental stimulus or even a stimulus by memory. That then triggers the body into feelings. So we'll have tachycardia or speeded up heart rate, perspiration, all that stuff, heightened awareness. Then, but we still don't have emotions because dogs have all of that, and dogs really don't have emotions in the way that humans do. What sets us apart is a cognitive structure that we start learning from the time when we're born. And basically what we do is we put symbolic labels on these affects that we experience and the feelings associated with them, and we begin to categorize these emotions in what we could essentially call a database. And we take the nine affects, and they start granulating into and categorizing into more and more refined emotions if we're lucky. Now, here's to answer the question, why is there violence? What happens is that if we do not learn, starting around 18 months, if we do not learn how to categorize and granularize emotions so we have a very rich emotional vocabulary to draw on symbolically, we cannot process what's going on in our brains. Because what happens is there's these feelings that occur, but we have to concretize them into consciousness in order to work with them. And only when we concretize them so that we can talk about them, we can communicate what we're feeling, we can look for cause and effect, and we can change or modify our behaviors consciously rather than unconsciously. That's why we have to categorize emotions and create symbolic meaning using words to create that. If we don't do that, then we're left with reactivity. That's all we have. And whatever programmed reactivity we have is what we do. So if a child is brought up in a violent environment, and that child's natural programming is going to be violent. And I witnessed that with every murderer I've ever worked with in prison. They all have the same story about violence in childhood. And if we do emotionally categorize, then over a period of time, when we granularize, then what happens is we are now able to draw in a cognitive understanding of what we're experiencing, process that emotion more effectively, and be less impulsive. So, that's what emotional intelligence is all about. The idea of emotional intelligence is that we are self-aware of our emotional experience, we're able to modulate our emotions, and we are able to make choices against what we are feeling in the moment. In other words, we have impulse control. And then on top of that, we're able to look at other people's emotions, read their emotions, and then empathically connect with them. Those are the five basic components of emotional intelligence. The sad thing is that this should be stuff that's taught to children by their parents. But because the parents don't know, because their parents didn't know, we tend to emotionally invalidate. And that is one of the most pervasive forms of emotional abuse that exists today. So everybody will relate to this. I mean, so I'm a male, and when I was a two-year-old, I'd stub my toe and start to cry, and I would be told, stop crying. Don't be a sissy. Don't be soft. Tough it up. Suck it up. You know, it doesn't hurt. You know, you got to be a man. Those are all deeply emotionally invalidating statements that are telling me at two-year-olds what? Emotions are bad. They're dangerous. And if I want to be a man, I can't feel anything. And this is what we do to our children. And as a result, I mean, think flash forward to 15. Now, we've got this young man who's interested in a girl for the first time and wants to date, and he's totally emotionally unavailable to himself, and we've got ourselves a train wreck, a relationship train wreck that persists on into life because we have emotionally invalidated the two-year-old. And that's the sad part of what goes on. There are some kids who are lucky to have parents who intuitively understand how to teach their children, but 99% of the world, it's just not that way. Just because of ignorance, we just don't know. Well, now we do know. And when you look at studies like the ACEs study out of San Diego that show us what happens when we emotionally invalidate children, that the consequences to their physical health and later in adult life are horrible, terrible. You know, this becomes not only does this become just an issue of peace, it becomes an issue of public health concerns. So it's a huge, huge issue. And up until just 10 years ago, we didn't know why any of this happened. But now, as neuroscience is slowly pulling back the shrouds around how our brains actually operate, we begin to realize that many of the practices that we engage in are based on myth, and they're just not only are they wrong, they're dangerous. And so now we can start changing because we know better. And that's kind of my message out there, is we know better, so let us change.
So, yes, great information. A couple of things I just wanted to comment on and kind of ask you to elaborate a bit more. The number one point that you're bringing up, and I've seen in my practice as a psychotherapist and working with relationships, is that we have not been taught about emotions. We haven't been taught we haven't been validated to have
Correct. That
range of expressions. And it does start early on in our life as a child when we're invalidated. We don't have role models that do it, and then how we've been taught and communication would be given to us, we reprogram. And, you know, what's so fascinating about that is that it shows up in every facet of our life, creating, as you were saying, huge stressors in the body, because it will show up in relationships, it'll show up in our workplace. I mean, we cannot escape the programming because we're interacting with other humans, and that behavior is going to manifest to the frustration of everyone involved, you know,
That's
oneself
right.
and also the people, family members. So we have the capacity to learn this. We haven't been taught how to do it, and until we have developed the skills, we'll run on the automatic programming. So that's why your work is so important, and I want you to elaborate in a minute. But I have another question I have to ask you. Where does the male and female brain come into this?
Well, you know, I think that's been overhyped. I think that all brains are the same, and essentially the same. I mean, there are obviously major differences between human beings, so that means the brains are different. But physiologically, you're going to find the same basic structures in all the right places. And there really isn't. I was just reading an interesting article on this the other day. There really isn't a male-female brain. There are certain aspects of the brain that activate or have richer connections that tend to be more female, but there are also connections that tend to be richer that tend to be more male-centric, and we have both of those. And so to say that there's a female brain or a male brain is probably not accurate. It's probably a bit of an oversimplification. And it just depends on what part of the brain is more enriched, probably, to say what this is a more female-centric type or more female-dominant type of part of the brain. But the brains are the same. It's just what parts of the brain are active, where the neural networks, where they're richer, and that sort of thing. And so there are very small differences between males and females in the brain. And brain mass is about the same relative to body size and all of that. So just like people talk about left brain, right brain, and left brain being – you know, reasoning and ration and, you know, mathematics and the right brain being intuitive, that's all wrong too. I mean, that's just a big myth. Both sides of the brain do both things. And, you know, it's been obvious from studies where the corpus callosum, the channel that connects the two hemispheres, have been severed for one reason or another. The people with split brains are able to function perfectly well, both in what we would call artistic intuitive stuff and in logical thinking. So, there's just a lot of myth out there and people make up these myths because you're trying to take something that is incredibly complex, of which we know very, very little really, and trying to simplify it down so that we can get our heads around it, when actually it's far more complex than most people think. And our knowledge base is great, but it is still not anywhere near where we hope it will be someday.
So why is it that when women get together, they tend to talk more about their feeling, nature, mm-hmm. the emotions? Men tend to talk more about politics, sport, and...
Right. It's culture. Yeah, well, it's culture. Totally culture. I mean, and when you're talking about Western culture, that's what men and women tend to do. If you went to some other culture, It would be different kinds of conversations, but that's all culture and environment. That has nothing to do with the brain. And why do men talk about sports and sex and stuff like that? Because they've been trained from the time they were 18 months old. At the time, their emotional centers were just beginning to come online, that emotions are bad, and that to touch your emotions, to be emotionally aware, is to be feminine, and that's a bad thing for a man to be. Because you might be vulnerable, you might be exploited, people might take advantage of you, and by God, you have to be competitor and win if you want to succeed in life. All wrong messages, all horrible messages, totally wrong, totally mythological, totally destructive. and a cause of a huge amount of grief in our society. But that's what our culture teaches, and it's wrong, and we need to change it. But that's why you have those different conversations going on.
Yeah, interesting. One last thing I want to ask you, and then I want you to talk about your work. What is the role of a person's health, nutrition, in terms of their moods and their, you know, the moods that get expressed, especially how it impacts, you know, the negative, what we call negative, but the more, you know, the anger, the more explosive, reactive emotions. What's your experience with that?
Well, I think it's clear that nutrition, having good sleep patterns, eating healthy foods, getting exercise, it's a whole life thing. And to the degree that any of that degrades, it degrades the performance of our brains. It especially degrades the part of our brain that is responsible for impulse control, which is the prefrontal cortex, the executive functions of the brain. And then the prefrontal cortex is supposed to put the brakes on when it's not appropriate. But all kinds of studies have shown that when people are tired, or when they have low blood sugar, or when they lack sleep, or whether they're under stress of some kind, or whether they're under a deep cognitive load, that impulse control goes out the window. I mean, there's a great study. In fact, there's some really funny YouTube videos out there. There was a great study done back in the 50s or 60s, I think, where they took four-year-olds. They took a four-year-old, and you put him in the room, and you say, if you don't eat that, and they put a cookie or a marshmallow in front of the kid. I think originally it was a marshmallow. The YouTube now, I think they're cookies. And they take this four-year-old and say, if you can not eat that marshmallow for the next, then until I come back in the room, then I'll give you two marshmallows. And what they did is they videotaped the kids, and they watched what happened. And so some kids were able to withstand the temptation, and other kids just couldn't help themselves, and they ate the marshmallow. They tracked their life histories. And the kids who ate the marshmallow, who lacked the impulse control at 4 years old, had much, much worse life outcomes than people who had impulse control, and the four-year-old was able to hold on and wait for the reward. I mean, phenomenal at 4 years old, how our brains have formed and how it sets our patterns for going forward in life. And so what's going on with a four-year-old brain? I mean, if that four-year-old is not getting sleep, or the two-year-old is not getting sleep, I mean, here's the other thing that's really incredible to talk about nutrition and the importance of this. At the beginning of the second trimester of pregnancy, the brain starts to form. And from the second trimester up until a couple of weeks before birth, neurons are being subdividing and replicating at the rate of 250,000 neurons per second. Think about that, because we got to have something like 5 or 8 trillion, billion neurons at birth. Do the math.
Well,
how long
it
takes, and it comes out to about 250,000 neurons per second. Now, imagine the pregnant mother being under stress, being in a violent situation, or being in an unhealthy situation, eating unhealthy food, drinking alcohol, smoking, having an addictive disorder, being depressed. Think about the effect it's having on that baby's brain.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yes, it is powerful. When I was a psychotherapist, I focused a lot on birth trauma and the environment in the womb. And we're getting set up in the very beginning. We're all getting set up. It's either for our betterment or for our challenges in life, right? And you put in the birth trauma experience or the birth experience, which you know, there's, you know, however way you look at it, it's a trauma to that child. You know, some of those imprints get laid down right there early on in one's life and get reinforced. They're down there at birth, and then they get reinforced in the environment.
That's right. Well, we know now from neuroscience that we can scan the brains of a three-year-old and with 80% accuracy predict whether or not they're going to prison or not.
And our prisons
now, that
are
doesn't
set up
mean
all wrong.
This stuff is, we think of babies as being these little blobs of wetness, but no, they are extremely complex beings doing extremely complex work, and the brain needs to go through certain developmental stages in the from the time of conception until 3 years old if the person's going to have a shot at having a healthy life. And if we don't give them proper nutrition and proper training and proper environmental stimuli at the proper time, then, you know, it's disaster. And I work in prisons, and I see this all the time. You can see the outcome of it, negative outcome.
And, I mean, you can see how ignorant we are as a culture and how to cultivate healthy, balanced, loving, compassionate, creative human beings.
And it's totally possible, and it's really easy. That's the thing that's so mind-boggling to me, is how easy it is to change direction. The techniques are they're counterintuitive, and they seem a little weird, but they work, and they work every time without fail, and they're amazing.
So I want you to talk about that, Doug, but I want you to first mention the fact that you're offering your book, which gives you all this information and instruction, and we're going to talk about it on the show, but people really need to have the book so they can learn more and share, which is De-escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less. Can you share what you're offering people?
Yeah, I have I've been blessed with a benefactor who is willing to buy the book for you. So if you're willing to pay the shipping and handling and taxes, which is about $7, it is $7, then we'll buy the book for you. And that way you've got skin in the game, and we'll pick up the rest of the cost of the book, which isn't much, but it's something. And if you want to take up that offer, just go to my website, DougNoll.com, DougNoll.com. There's a banner there. Click on the banner. It'll take you over to the order form. Just pay your $7, put in your shipping information, and it'll be out to you in a couple of days.
And that offer is only within the U.S., right? Because I do have listeners.
Right. It's only good within the U.S. We have a hard time shipping overseas.
Yeah. Okay.
That is a limitation. So for U.S. residents only.
Okay. Okay. So can we dive into your work and
yes.
what you are teaching people? Because
sure.
Let's do it.
Three simple steps. Take out a piece of paper. Write these down. There's going to be a quiz at the end. I'm a law professor. I can't help myself. All right, here are the steps. Step number one, you're confronting an angry person, or an angry person is confronting you. It could be a 2-year-old having a tantrum. Could be a 90-year-old. It could be a 40-year-old acting like a 2-year-old. It doesn't matter. You've got somebody really pissed off in front of you. First thing you're going to do is ignore the words. For the next 90 seconds, the words that person is speaking mean nothing. It's just hot air and noise, and you're just going to ignore it. Nothing there of any value for you to listen to, so just ignore those words. Step number two, you're going to guess at what you think that speaker is feeling. What emotions is this person experiencing in this moment? And obviously, if they're angry or upset, it'll be obvious, anger and upset. However, emotions always come in complexes. They come in layers all the time. So underneath that anger is going to be a whole bunch of other stuff. And what you're going to want to start to do is guess at what might be underneath the anger. Then the third step, and this is the secret sauce and also the counterintuitive part and also the part that hangs people up, is that you are going to reflect back the emotions that you guess the speaker is experiencing using a very simple use statement. So you'll say something like, Cheryl, you're really angry right now. You're really frustrated. You're really anxious. You don't feel like you're being listened to. Nobody's supporting you. You feel completely betrayed. And you're a little sad, because you feel all alone. And that's exactly how you would do it. No I statements. You would never use an I statement. You never would say something, gee, Cheryl, what I think you're feeling is anger. Wrong. The moment you start talking about I statements, it becomes about you. You, the listener. You want to focus totally on the speaker B and their experience. The second thing that you don't do is you don't ask questions. Gee, Cheryl, are you angry? You would never do that either. All the research shows that when you use I statements or ask questions, the brain processes that kind of information, the speaker's brain processes that very differently than when you use just a direct use statement. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to do this. I say 90 seconds or less. Typically, it takes about 30 to 40 seconds. But you do this until you get you're looking for four involuntary responses, involuntary and unconscious responses from your speaker. Number one, you're going to get a nod of the head, up and down, yes. You're going to get a verbal response, sometimes quite sharp. They'll say, exactly, that's exactly how I'm feeling. You're going to get a dropping of the shoulders, and you're going to get a deep sigh or a release of air. The lungs will release air in a relief as a form of relief. And these four things all happen unconsciously and outside the conscious control of the speaker. And when you see those, you know you've done it right and you started to de-escalate. And then when you get them calmed down, it usually takes, like I said, 35 to 40 seconds, sometimes as long as a minute. That's when you can start to problem solve. But you cannot do any problem solving until you get them calmed down. So if somebody's really angry, you're really angry, you're really frustrated, you know, as I said, maybe, and then what are the feelings underneath that? Go deeper. And then finally they get calmed down. You say, well, all right, so what should we do about this? And you invite them to start talking about, okay, what do we need to do to make things right and to prevent this from happening again? Do they get escalated again? You just de-escalate them, and it becomes an iterative process. In a very conflictual mediation process, conflict where I'm mediating, I might de-escalate people 50 times a day. You know, 50 times during the course of a 9 or 10-hour day, I'll be de-escalating them. They get riled up, I calm them down. They get riled up, and then calm down. It works. It works every time because our brains are hardwired, and Lieberman's study in 2007 showed why it works. And so now we know that when we do it this particular way and no other way, don't deviate from this one bit, it's extremely effective.
Does it change the brain of the person you're de-escalating when you do that?
It does. What happens is...
Well, I mean, long-term, is it...
Oh, long-term. Well, yeah, you know... Yes, it does. In fact, I want parents to be doing this to 18-month-olds all the way through childhood. If you label your child's emotions, one, you stop the tantrums in their tracks. No more tantrums, no more arguments, no more fights. And two, you're helping that child develop emotional granularization, what I was talking about before. You're helping that child build an emotional database. Remember, at 18 months and 2 years old, the emotional centers of the brain are now coming online. And it's the job of the brain, that's why we call it the terrible twos, is because in order for the brain to make the neuronal connections to figure out what emotions are all about, you have to experience all these emotions. So a two-year-old can be rapturously joyous in one moment and have road rage in the next moment. And that's because the brain is going through all these emotions to learn what they are all about. And yet we call it the terrible twos because the kid seems like they're crazy. They're not. Their brains are just experimenting. If we can help that child develop emotional granularity by labeling his emotions, what his or her emotional experience is, we give that child a precious gift that will last a lifetime. Powerful.
And will the child acknowledge the fact that, you know, if you say to a child, well, I can see you're feeling really frustrated and you must be really unhappy.
No, I statement. I can see that you're feeling really frustrated. This is something that's really hard for people to do because we've been trained to use I statements. I statements the reason that we use I statements, by the way, first of all, we've been taught there are various methods of active listening that teach this that are wrong. But second, we mostly do it because for self-soothing, to soothe our own anxiety. So we have to break that habit and we have to say you're really frustrated, you're really angry, you just want to hit something, you're so mad. Something like that. And the child will say, yeah.
Really, even like an 18-month-old, they will respond to that.
Absolutely. 18-month, not so much. 2-year-old, they're not quite as verbal yet, but 2-year-old, definitely. Definitely a 2-year-old will
understand.
Respond positively.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So the formula is pretty simple. I mean, it seems to me pretty simple. It does take
practice. Very simple.
Can you share some of the transformative experiences that have happened in the different environments? I know you've worked in prisons. Maybe we can talk a bit about what you've experienced in
The first time the first time I saw this really come to full flower in prison was we were about 5 weeks into our first cohort of women when we first started the Prison of Peace Project in 2010. This would have been early May of 2010. And we were at that time working in what was then the largest, most violent women's prison in the world. And we were working with 15 women who were long-termers or lifers, teaching them how to become mediators and peacemakers. And Laurel Coffer, my colleague, and I, as we designed the curriculum, decided the first thing we had to do is teach them how to do this type of affect labeling, because this type of reflective listening, along with other kinds of – there are four levels of reflective listening. This is the deepest. But we had to teach them these four levels of reflective listening. So we came into the room one day, and in the corner was one of our students, a woman, and she was quietly crying, sobbing. And so Laura walked over to her, and this is the story she told her. She said, "I've been in prison for over 10 years. When I came to prison, I had to turn my son over to my sister who has been raising him. I've written him every single week for 10 years. I've never heard a word from him. Last week, I decided to write a letter based on the skills that you guys have been teaching us. And today I got a letter from him, and he's coming to visit with his girlfriend in 2 weeks." And we just sort of said that, holy crap, what are we doing here? Because it was obviously just so powerful that just even by writing a letter and Affic labeling how he, what his emotional experience must be to be abandoned by his mother in prison, by writing from his perspective and from his point of view, she was able to touch him in a way that made him finally feel validated. His mother was validating him, and he had the ability to write back and come and arrange for a visit.
I have had that healing happen.
Hundreds of stories along the similar lines. I mean, just recently, a week ago, I'm working in the men's prison over in San Luis Obispo, California, and a guy came up to me and said, "I got to tell you this story." And he said, "I've been in prison for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and always when I talk to my wife and my children, they don't want to talk to me because I'm always talking about me and what my problems are." And he said, "Now you're teaching me these skills," and I decided to see how they would work with my family. And he said, "Now I validate their emotions in the way that you've taught us to do that. I'm reflecting back. I'm telling them what their emotional experiences are. I'm guessing at it, reflecting it back, and it's not about me at all. And they want to talk to me now. All they want to do is talk to me and tell me what's going on in their lives and have me reflect back what they're experiencing. And it's not about me at all. The moment it stopped being about me is when I started having a relationship with my family for the first time, and it took me going to prison to learn how to do this." How sick is that?
And there are amazing things happening in the prison system from people who've been learning from you. Do you want to share how that's kind of expanded and making an impact?
We started the project in 2009 in response to a letter that Laurel had received from a woman serving a life sentence without possibility of parole at Valley State Prison for Women. And we took us 6 months to get clearances, and we finally got the project started in April of 2010 with 15 women. And by the time we were done, and our goal was to teach them how to become peacemakers and mediators so that they could step into arguments and fights and stop those arguments and fights before they escalated into violence, because that's what the women were really looking for. And so we set up a whole curriculum of skills that we thought they would need before we could actually teach them how to become mediators. So they get 84 hours of training compared to the typical mediation classes, which last anywhere from 12 to 40 hours, depending upon what's going on. But we figured inmates really needed some foundational listening skills, and then they needed some practice at group process and leading groups and learning how to work with groups. So we taught them peace circles, and then eventually they get enough experience and they're ready to learn how to become mediators. So we taught the first 15 women. By the time we were done with that, there was a long waiting list of women wanting to be trained. I know, 300, 400 women wanting the training. We were doing this pro bono. I mean, we're not getting paid for this. We're paying for everything out of our own pockets. We're doing this on our own time as professional mediators and lawyers. So we decided to keep going. And 3 years later, we had trained over 1,000 women in the prison, and we had trained up about 30 or 40 trainers, and the prison was the project was going gung-ho. We got an unsolicited letter from the warden who said, "As a result of your work, this place is very much, much quieter than it's ever been before. Its reputation has gone away. This is now a quiet, peaceful prison, and it's due to the work of the women that you've been training." That was pretty cool. So then the state decided to repurpose the prison into a men's prison, so the women were shipped off to the two other women's prisons, and we told them we would follow them wherever they went. One's in Southern California, one's in Central California. And then we started getting calls from the warden, now a new warden, coming in to open up the men's prison, saying, "Would you please bring Prison of Peace to the men?" And we said, "No, we're not getting paid. We can't afford to do this. It's practically bankrupting us as it is." But finally we said yes. And so then 3 years, it's been now 3.5 years, it'll be 4 years in October, next month, 4 years we've been working in the men's prison. And we have the same effect. We've trained 1,000 men or so. We've got 30 or 40 men coming up. They're about to be certified as mediation trainers, and it's fully embedded in the prison. And the same, to the same effect. Men are actually easier to train than the women, as it turns out. Then we started, the Department started of Corrections and Rehabilitation, came out with some innovation programming grants. We applied for the grants, wanting to expand, and we were turned down the first 2 years, but this last year we finally got a major grant to expand into 6 more prisons. So now we're in 9 prisons in California, teaching various levels of prison of peace, and we have a colleague who came over and studied with us for 6 months, and now she has got 3 prisons in Greece, around Athens, that are Greece, and she's translated all the materials into Greek, and she, with a colleague over there, are teaching inmates to be peacemakers and mediators with our model there. And we, of course, we have inquiries from all over the place, people wanting to start prison of peace in their various states and jurisdictions and countries. But it's just 2 of us. We have one full-time employee, and we're just operating on these relatively large for us, but relatively small grants to pay our expenses and pay us a little bit. I mean, we charge about 1/3 of what our professional hourly rates are. And it's been amazing work. It's very challenging. It's very difficult. It's very frustrating. Prison bureaucracies are very difficult to work with, and they will tell you that to your face. Say, yes, we're very difficult to work with. They are. But we persist because the work we do is so powerful. We work mostly with lifers and long-termers. We have had a number of inmates get out, released on parole, and to our knowledge, we have 0 recidivism or reoffending. We have had no reports of any prison of peace people who have been released having any problems other than great success in life when they get out because of the skills that they've learned that we've taught them.
Wow. That's so inspiring. So, and I mean, we can have a whole conversation about prison systems and all the
right.
wounded people and abuse.
Oh, yeah. And
traumatized
they are.
People. Mm-hmm. And we have the system is so wrong. How we deal with these people is so wrong. But
that's right.
another conversation.
That's right.
But I want to just shift us over to applying this model to relationships. And I know you have a chapter there about divorce. And I think
right.
I just want you to talk a bit about that because so many people, when they're in a divorce process, are so bitter and angry. And everyone
yes.
suffers. The children suffers. It's highly stressful to everyone involved. And it's obviously a serious lack of skills and resources to process
right.
all that's gone on. So can you talk a little bit about how you help people who are in that situation?
Well, let me tell you a story about how I stumbled onto these skills. And that story involved a couple who had actually been divorced, and they'd been divorced for a number of years. And the ex-husband ended up suing the ex-wife for an $18,000 problem, and they'd spent $50,000 in attorney's fees. Typical. And I was called in because people were their lawyers were really at their wit's end as to what to do with these people. And so I got in the conference room, and they were sitting down. Their lawyers weren't present. I was doing this just as a joint session without lawyers. And I hadn't even settled into my seat when they started screaming at each other, just cussing each other out, really despicable language. I mean, really an anger, raw, hard anger. And I couldn't get them to stop. So suddenly the thought came to me, listen to the emotions. So I did my Moses parting the water thing where I stand up and spread my hands and say, be quiet. And I look at Susan and I said, Susan, what I want you to do right now is I want you to ignore John's words. And I want you to guess at what he's feeling. See where this came from? I want you to guess at what he's feeling, and then I want you to tell us what you think John is feeling. I just made this up on the spot. I don't know where it came from. It just came to me. So we went through this process. And in the beginning, it was very difficult for her. But finally, she got it. And then when John finished his story and was listened to, his feelings were listened to, not his words, I had John do the same thing to Susan. And when they finished, this took about 20 minutes to get through all of this, he put his head in his hands, and he started sobbing. And he's a big guy, big burly guy. He started sobbing. And finally, the emotion passed, and he looked up at her and said, that's the first time you've listened to me in 25 years. And the case settled 5 minutes after that. And I said, holy crap, what just happened here? And it wasn't until 3 years later that the Lieberman study came out that explained that what I had stumbled across was actually Susan lending her prefrontal cortex to John so he could process his emotions and feel deeply validated, and he doing the same for her. And when they started really listening to each other's emotional experiences and not their words, they, for the first time in a relationship that went back 30 years, finally heard each other and were able to resolve this problem.
Now, when you think about that, you know, 30 years of carrying the wounds that never let
right.
either one of them be validated for what they were feeling, and
right.
it led to, I mean, obviously, 30 years of immense stress, and then
right.
Culminating in this vitriolic war.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly correct. And the whole thing turned in less than 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And that's when my eyes really got open to this, and I said, holy moly, there's something really powerful going on here. And that's when I started studying and trying to understand, what did I just do? And can I do it again? And what's really going on in the brain here? Why did this work? I've never heard of anything like this. Everybody talks about reflective listening. You're supposed to reflect back the words, and obviously that doesn't work. So why does this work and that doesn't? And then I started studying it, and then I finally began to understand why. And then
yeah,
I started teaching it.
And the powerful thing about the skills that you're teaching is that the skills can be applied to every facet of life. They can be applied to bringing up our children in schools, in relationships, in, you know, the prison situations, in work situations.
I've had therapists tell me that have gone through my training saying, why didn't I learn this 40 years ago?
Yeah.
This is the most powerful stuff I've ever learned, and I'm learning it from a lawyer. What's that all about? You know, and they're kind of laughing. But you're right. It can be applied to any relationship situation. But let me just say this. This is important to know. This skill, you can get the book, study it. I also have a video course. You can get, if you buy the book, you get a chance to get the video course if you want, 4 hours of really intense training to really learn this stuff. But here's something that people have to understand. This is like learning how to ride a bike. It's so counterintuitive to anything you've ever done before that you just can't expect to read the book or take the video course and walk out and start doing this. You've got to practice it. So what I tell people to do is when you walk into Starbucks, your favorite coffee place or wherever in the morning, start using this in very low-risk, safe social situations. So one of the things that you might want to do is look at the barista or the person taking your credit card and say, hey, you look really happy this morning. Give them a very positive label, a positive reflection, because they are probably happy. Those kinds of people usually are, even if it's 5 in the morning. And watch what happens. Watch for the 4 unconscious responses, and you will see them. And do this for at least a week with people that you barely know or don't know with a positive emotion, and just see for yourself how it works. Because until you actually do this, it's very hard to believe that something this simple can be this powerful. And so practice, experiment with it. Like I tell people, don't listen to the great Doug Knoll. Go out and the world is your laboratory. Go out there and test it yourself. And play around with I statements and watch what the difference is when you use an I statement versus when you use a you statement. And what's the difference when you ask a question versus a you statement? And find out for yourself why I'm so adamant about using you statements directly. And you'll see. It's very obvious. And you'll see it and you'll get it and you'll say, ah, I understand. And once you've done this for a couple of weeks, then you'll have the confidence to be able to walk into something that's a little more intense and start using this on your children or on your spouse or coworkers, friends, family, whatever, and it'll start to work for you.
Okay, so people need to go to your website, which is Douglas Knoll. I think Doug Knoll will also get you there, douglasknoll.com. And when you go to Doug's website, you can take advantage of his offer of getting a free book, just paying for the postage, which I think is incredible, incredible offer. I would encourage everyone listening to go do that. And then you also have, I gather what you were saying, Doug, is you have a training program, an online or video training program where people can master the skills that we're talking about today.
Right. So the way I've got that set up very simply is that I don't want people taking the video course unless they buy the book. Because there's no point in not having the book there to help you through the stuff. So if you buy the book, that means you're interested enough to learn. Then you'll be taken to a page that where you can buy the video course if you're interested. If you're not interested, that's fine, cool. Just click on the button and say no thanks, and the book will be on its way. But it is an offer that you can get, and the course is deeply discounted because I want as many people as possible to learn this if they're interested in learning it. So I'm putting the resources out there hoping that people will start to learn this stuff practice it. I am completely accessible. I'm a one-man shop. I don't have secretaries or assistants or anything else. I work out of my home. People can email me. They can call me. I'm happy to talk to people until I get so busy that I can't, and I'm out there. But I try to be very responsible and accessible to people because I really want these skills to get out there. If I can keep one kid from going to prison because mom and dad ethic labeled that kid, labeled back his or her emotions to them as a two-year-old, then that's a really great thing. And that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah, how wonderful. You know, last night I saw this new documentary that's out called Rooted in Peace. Rooted in Peace. Mm-hmm. And they have people like Deepak Chopra and Tibetan lamas and all sorts of people they're interviewed. And this guy's talking about the journey to creating peace in the world. So when I hear the work you're doing, and just because I saw that wonderful documentary, you know, this is what you are contributing to the world. It's helping to create a world that is rooted in peace. And I really want to acknowledge you and congratulate you and have the utmost respect for everything you're doing because it really is making a difference. And it's so needed in transforming this world, Doug. So thank you for all the hard work put into it.
I appreciate that, but I can't do it alone. If we want to calm this angry world that we live in right now, we all have to learn these skills and start applying them. We can't rely on our political leaders to teach us how to do this because obviously it's in their best interest for there to be incivility. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't be uncivil with each other and to the rest of the world. They're all interested in tribalism and pitting groups against groups so that they can aggregate power to themselves. If we're tired of that, regardless of what your political belief is, if you're tired of that stuff, then we can change it. But we have to start with ourselves and our families, our neighborhoods, our communities. And if we do this, if we get enough people, a critical mass of people working these skills, we can change our society very, very rapidly for a much better place to live for everybody.
And that makes me feel so much better. It's really an inspiration. And I want to thank you for the great work you're doing. Everyone should go up to Doug's site, douglasknoll.com, get the book, get the course, start making a difference in your world and your family. So it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. And
thank you, Cheryl. It's been a great conversation.
I so appreciate it. Everyone, pick up De-Escalate, How to Calm an Angry Person in 90 Seconds or Less for free by just going to douglasknoll.com. And remember, until next time, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.